Hi, friends. This is Dr. Michael Williams, and welcome back to another episode of the Diversify and Path podcast. This podcast explores how investing in diversity can lead to a high return of investment in pathology and laboratory medicine by learning from the knowledge and experiences of diverse voices within our field. My next guest is Dennis Strank. Dennis Strank has been a certified pathologist assistant since 2003 and also has a pistol technologist certification. Since 2018, he has worked at Wisconsin Diagnostic Laboratories in an academic medical center. From 2009 through 2018, he was the editor-in-chief of The Cutting Edge, the Journal of the American Association of Pathologist Assistants, and served on the board of trustees of the AAPA from 2018 through 2020. In the summer of 2019, Dennis launched the People of Pathology podcast, in which he interviews people in pathology and lab medicine. The podcast has listeners in over 40 countries and is ranked number 2 on FeedSpot's list of 20 pathology podcasts you must follow in 2021. He is a member of the American Association of Pathology Assistants, the American Society for Clinical Pathology, and was named to the 2021 Power List by the Pathologist magazine. Without further ado, here's Dennis Strank. Hi again, friends. Welcome back to another episode of the Diversify and Path podcast. I'm here with my next guest. So can you tell me who you are, where you are from, and your pronouns?
Hi, I'm Dennis Strank. I am from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I'm a pathologist assistant, and pronouns he, him, his.
So can you tell us how you got involved with pathology and your route to becoming a pathologist assistant?
Yeah. So it's a little bit non-traditional. I got out of college with a degree in biology, and I couldn't get a job with that degree. I at the time, I wanted to get into microbiology, but I didn't know anything about microbiology in a hospital lab. I thought it was just like research and, you know, things like that in these big, like I wanted to work at the CDC. I thought that was, you know, kind of the goal there. So I got out of college, I couldn't get a job, and you know, I applied everywhere. There's a medical college here in Milwaukee. I applied, you know, all of their kind of research positions that were available and never got anything. Eventually went back to school for phlebotomy, which I think my mom had suggested, like, oh, you need some kind of skill and, you know, you can learn phlebotomy. It was like a 1-year program at the time. And then you could get into a hospital lab and maybe branch off to something else from there. So made sense. It wasn't really, I mean, I don't have anything against phlebotomists. I have a lot of respect for them, but it wasn't something that I wanted to do, but mm-hmm. I needed something. So I went back and I did kind of the didactic part. That was like the first semester. And then the second semester was supposed to be the clinical stuff. And towards the end of that first semester, I ended up actually getting a job in histology department at one of the hospitals here in Milwaukee as a lab assistant. And I remember I had applied for, it was a different lab position or a lab assistant position in the same hospital, but it was like in specimen processing. And they called me and they said, you know, we filled that position, but there's this other one in lab assistant position in histology. And, you know, what do you know about histology? And I said, that's a study of tissues, right? And so, because in college, now let me kind of go back. When I was in college, like I said, I wanted to get into micro. And I remember one of the biology classes, there was like a unit on histology. And so, you know, we looked at a couple of organs. I remember there was a heart, and then we looked at some things, some slides under the microscope and looking at, which I learned later were like H&E stains and some other stains and whatever. And I remember, and I'll never forget this, I remember thinking, this is completely stupid. Why would anyone want to do this for a job? and that's where I ended up. So anyway, yeah. So I got the job as a lab assistant in histology, and there was a PA there at the time. Her name was Janine. And so most of my job was kind of, because this was in the late 90s, so it was like I had to stand next to her as she was grossing, and we had this big log book, and I had to write down number of pieces, like, this is the case number, this is what kind of tissue it is, and this is how many cassettes and how many pieces. I mean, it was that long ago. And just was super fascinated with what she was doing.
Right.
And and then from there, because I worked second shift, so after Janine went home for the day, then I would kind of, you know, I'd be filing slides or whatever and talking to the histotech that was there. And okay, what are you doing? What's this job about? Whatever. And she, you know, kind of showed me what, you know, this is embedding and this is cutting and then staining is this and whatever. And I started asking, like, the supervisor, like, how do you learn how to do this? You know, is there school for this or whatever? And she eventually found out that because I had a college degree, I could learn that on the job. You know, there were certain requirements and things like that. So I started doing that and became a histotechnologist. And then the PA, Janine, she had left, and we got another PA whose name is Sandra. And so I was kind of like part-time studying to be a histotech and part-time still doing kind of lab assistant, assisting with grossing kind of things. And Sandra started showing me how to gross, you know, biopsies and, you know, small specimens. And we did, you know, gallbladder and appendix and things like that. She would, you know, be standing right next to me. We've kind of switched places, and I would do the grossing part, and she would tell me what to say and where to cut and what to look for and all these things. She was very hands-on. You know, we moved up to, we started doing, like, uterus for prolapse and placenta, you know, like that. And then she eventually took a job somewhere else, so she left. And the lead pathologist at the time, he said, he noticed that I was interested in this, and he said, well, you know, we can probably just teach you the rest of these things. He's like, why don't we kind of hire you on as sort of a PA in training? Because at that time too, you could do on the job training as a PA. You had to train on the job for 3 years, and then you could sit for the same exam that all the program trained PAs took. So I thought, well, okay. Yeah. So I'd been working, I worked for like almost a year as like a, I guess it's called, nowadays you'd call it a grossing tech. I did that, and then they started training me, you know, teaching me more complicated specimens, and then, you know, did that three-year kind of, it wasn't really a program because it was very sort of loose, but you had like a, again, more requirements for those things and different type of specimens that you had to know how to do.
Right.
And then, yeah, and then just did it that way and eventually sat for the exam and passed it. My entire career is all of these things kind of accidentally falling in my lap. I got very good at being in the right place at the right time. It wasn't really consciously, but I knew enough to grab the opportunities when I was presented with them. And that's how I got to where I am.
If you can go back, would you tell yourself, I guess, when you were just finishing college, would you tell yourself to go the PA route, or do you think like it happened because you were exposed to so many different parts of the lab or of the lab in general?
I've thought about that one a lot because my life could be very different, and I think that it happening the way that it did, you know, because if I'd have gotten out of college and gone right to PA school, I never would have been a lab assistant, and I still try to, you know, I never would have been a histotech, and I try to, the things that I do now, the work as a PA, you know, I always keep in mind, okay, you know, I make sure my sections are the correct size because I know how hard it is to have to embed and cut, you know, sections that are too big or too thick or whatever, you know, and I'm very respectful of the histotechs and of the lab assistants because I used to be them. And so like, you know, they say never forget where you came from or whatever.
Right, right.
So I try to do that. So I think, you know, so I wouldn't have had that experience. I would never have met Janine. I would never have met Sandra or, you know, some of the other PAs I worked with after that, Beth and Susan and Faith and all these other people. because I would have probably been working somewhere else, you know, right. And a lot of those people are still, you know, we're still friends to this day, mm-hmm. you know? So I think even though it might've been the more roundabout and kind of harder way to do it, I wouldn't trade it.
I wasn't aware. I mean, I went the medical school route, but say for example, if I was just like, all right, I stopped at the bachelor's portion. I was like, what do I do next? I had no idea about the existence of like histotechnologists or pathologist assistants or anybody yeah. else that works with the lab. What would you say to, let's say, like high school students or even undergraduates who want to do something that's part of the laboratory and ways of having them get exposed to that, the aspect as a potential like career pathway for them?
You know, and I didn't know anything about any of those fields either. I mean, mm-hmm. all that I knew about was, I mean, it was called medical technologist at the time. That's the mm-hmm. only lab mm-hmm. career I had ever heard of through college. And I think there needs to be more outreach to high school and college students as far as, mm-hmm. you know, pathologist assistant and histotechnologist and cytotechnologist and all of those, you know, even pathologist, you know, in general, people don't hear about all of those things. So there needs to be more outreach. And I think if anybody is interested in something like that, to shadow is probably the best way to do it, which maybe, right. you know, right now is probably not so much of an option. But if mm-hmm. it is, that's the best way to do, because that's what it was for me. Once I got in there and I started to see what happened in there, mm-hmm. I fell in love with the field. Like, I don't mm-hmm. regret that for a second. So, and I think that could happen for other people to really see what happens in there.
So tell us your approach to teaching residents and others as a PA when they're grossing a specimen. Do you get like excited and be like, we have an amazing like specimen today? Or are you just like, all right, this is how we do it? Like, what's your fun teacher approach?
You know, we don't have a lot of, I work with residents, but we don't have a lot of, they're mostly taught by the attendings, and we're kind of the sort of resource if they have questions. But okay. I try to, I guess my approach is more like, okay, what do you need? If you've got a complex specimen, say a cancer resection, mm-hmm. what do you need for, like, what information do you need to stage this specimen? Mm-hmm. What margins do you mm-hmm. need? What measurements do you need? What type of description do you need? And then you can approach the specimen like that. Like, this is the information that I need to provide. And then you mm-hmm. go, all right, how do I provide that information? Okay, well, I've got to ink it here. I've got to cut it this way so that I can measure this and like that. And to sort of, I guess, almost do it in reverse. Mm-hmm. Like, figure mm-hmm. out the information that you need at the end and then go back, all right, keep going a step back until you're at the beginning and like, all right, so you have to start like this so that you can do these steps, get to the end.
Right. Okay.
So that's what I try to do. And, you know, where I work, we see complex specimens, like that's the majority of our day. So it's really, and some of this stuff is like things that I've never seen before. So mm-hmm. it's, mm-hmm. I find it exciting, and I try to show that excitement to the residents, and it doesn't always work, which I understand. But mm-hmm. I love that I get to see all these things, and I get to do this every day. You know, I mm-hmm. go to work and I tell people all the time, I see interesting things every single day, and not right. everybody can say that. So I try to convey okay. that to the residents.
Gotcha. And like early when I meant like being fun and dance around, of course we don't dance around in the gross room with knives because that would be dangerous. So we don't want that. But
right.
But let's take a turn. I told you we were going to bring this up about your dancing right. and Justin Timberlake. Right. Tell us about that, Mama, because it sounded fun. And let me just give a preference for y'all. So because of the birthday, and I had impossible wishes, and I was like, things to dance and to sing to. And you were like, if it's Justin Timberlake, I'll be there. And I'm like, okay, all right. So let's hear more about this Justin Timberlake in a dancing.
Okay. So this goes back a few years. Justin Timberlake was on, it was some award show. I don't even remember what it was. Grammys, maybe something like that, whatever. But he was performing, and I didn't know anything about him. You know, mm-hmm. I'd never followed, what was it, NSYNC or any of that stuff. You know what I mean? Like, this mm-hmm. was not, this was out of my musical preferences, I guess. But my wife and I were watching whatever the show was, and he was performing, and he did the song Suit and Tie. Mm-hmm. And I watched this, and the way he was singing and dancing and just, like, owning the stage. And I'm watching this, and I was just mesmerized. Like, this guy is so smooth. Like, he can do it all, right?
Uh-huh.
So I went on Facebook, and I posted, you know, because you could say, you know, watching whatever TV show, like, I don't know if you can still do that on Facebook, but you could kind of tag whatever show you were watching.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and then I tagged my wife with me, and, like, I said something like, I think I have a man crush on Justin Timberlake. And it got like so much response. Like, people just ate it up.
Uh-huh.
So then they started going, then it was like, oh, have you seen him on Saturday Night Live? Which I mm-hmm. hadn't. So then people were like sending me these videos of like all these things he did, you know, on Saturday Night Live, and these different, when he was hosting or when he was performing, or the different skits and whatever. And then, like, okay, he's really funny too. So it's, he really does, you know, he can sing, he can dance, and he's hilarious. I mean, he's really funny.
Mm-hmm.
So then this was like an ongoing thing on Facebook. And then he would show up at other things, and, you know, I'd post, oh, guess what I'm watching, or guess who's on TV again, or something like this. And, like, oh, these people just kept responding to all of this stuff, and it just kind of grew from there.
Mm-hmm.
And then at work, it was like, oh, my, it was my birthday, which was in mm-hmm. March, whatever year it happened to be. And, like, I come in on my birthday, because it happened to be a weekday, and there's all these, like, people had printed out, like, pictures of Justin Timberlake, and it's like, happy birthday from Justin, and blah, blah, whatever, all this stuff. And it was, like, all over the grocery room. So it really, it got out of control in a hurry. But uh-huh. I do enjoy his music. I've mm-hmm. never seen him live, but I like his stuff, and, you know, sometimes I'll listen in the car, and I will sing along poorly, but I will try.
All right. Okay.
That is the Justin Timberlake story.
Have you ever attempted, like, the singing and dancing? Have you ever tried to own the stage at all?
Like, not on your daily? Not in public.
Listen, I mean, I'm saying, when I'm, like, you know, in my place, in my space, you know, I mean, I tell everybody, you know, it's Whitney, there's Monica. I can't sing for nothing, but I'm like, all right, you know, I'm grooving to it. So I guess I didn't know if you were doing the same thing, where you would just, like, come in, you'd be like, you know what, it's Justin time, and you start, like, grooving to it, and, you know, have your own stage in your house. Okay. All right.
Yeah, I mean, I've kind of gotten mostly over that sort of stage, but yeah, I have done that, and when you talk about that kind of stuff, I totally get it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally understand.
Yes. People know. You know, so I think this transitions to the fact of us talking and your podcast. And I'm sure you probably told the story a thousand times, but where did the idea come from for starting a podcast for yourself?
So that was probably spring or summer of 2019. Mm-hmm. And I was talking with a friend, another PA friend, and about, because we sort of connected with each other through some podcasts that we liked, that we both mm-hmm. liked. And so we were talking about that and some, you know, some other things about our job and whatever. And this was just like messaging through, I think through Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And we eventually started talking, like, you know, there aren't any podcasts for people that work in the lab or people that work in pathology.
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't it be great if there was, you know, that we could, you know, people like us could talk about the jobs that we do, and other people could hear about us, mm-hmm. and it's things like that. And a lot of the podcasts that I like are the interview style, Mm-hmm. They're just, mm-hmm. I don't know, they're just the most interesting to me. And she said to me, my friend, she said, you know, you should start a podcast. And, you know, I'm writing a book and you can interview me about the book and that can be like practice for you. Mm-hmm. I thought, oh, okay. So then I, you know, like I know you told me, so you go and you start researching. How do you do this? What equipment do you need? You know, you need a hosting platform. You need some way to record. You need a decent microphone and all this stuff. And I started realizing that it wasn't that hard, mm-hmm. and it wasn't that expensive. I mean, you could make it expensive, sure, and you could probably make it really hard too. Mm-hmm. But you didn't have to. It was pretty easy to start off. So I thought, all right,
yeah.
you know, let me try it. So, you know, we figured out what we were going to talk about in the interview, and we recorded it twice because the first time it sounded awful, and the second mm-hmm. time it still sounded kind of bad because I didn't know what I was doing, but it mm-hmm. sounded okay, and that became like the first episode. So I, you know, I made a logo, and I, you know, figured out how to upload it to the hosting platform and all this stuff, and
yeah,
that was the first episode, and that became like, you know, through Twitter and other social media, like I was meeting, you know, and talking with all these other people from different areas of the lab. Yeah. And I thought, well, you know, what if I, because I only know what I do and, you know, sort of kind of marginally what a pathologist does. So there's all these mm-hmm. other positions in the lab that I didn't understand, you know, the clinical laboratory scientists, you know, and just all of that in cytology and all those other areas that I'd never experienced. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I thought, what if I include them too? So it wasn't just, because originally it was just going to be like kind of PAs and pathologists. And I thought, well, I'm going to include all these other lab areas too, mm-hmm. because those sound interesting. And then, you know, forensic pathology sounds cool. So maybe I'll get a forensic pathologist, but then, you know, so I did that and it got more like, well, there's other areas of forensics that sound interesting also. So I started getting into those things and it just sort of expanded mm-hmm. like that. And it just kept growing like that. And mm-hmm. I found that I really enjoyed doing it. And I really enjoy talking with, basically talking with strangers, which is something my wife says, it's like way outside of my box. She says that's like her phrase for it because uh-huh. That's not something I normally do in, you know, I'm like the quiet guy. So talking with mm-hmm. strangers, you know, is unusual for me, but I find that I enjoy it and I've learned so much from all these people. It's really been fun so far.
Where do you see the podcast growing? Or do you have like, where do you see it being in the future? Or do you just feel like it'll just naturally grow and you're just enjoying the journey?
I mean, it has kind of naturally grown slowly. Mm-hmm. You know, so the first episode came out in December of 2019, and it's mm-hmm. it has gradually grown since then. And, you know, I don't know. And part of it, too, was like I wanted to start from zero. So, like, mm-hmm. I you know, I had, like, my Twitter that, you know, wasn't, you know, I'm not like super popular or any of those people, but so I created a new Twitter account just for the podcast and I started from zero and I didn't even mention it on my own sort of personal Twitter mm-hmm. account. I just wanted it completely separate and I wanted to see if I could start it from zero and see how I could make it grow and then what would I have to do to make that happen. So I've, right. you know, been trying all these different things and like, I don't know where I see it in the future. You know, I'm trying to explore as many areas of pathology and lab medicine and forensics that I can, and there are so many. Mm-hmm. And then I've been trying to cover, like, different countries, too. You know, I've had mm-hmm. some people from Canada, the UK, Brazil. Most recently, I had a pathologist from Finland. So it's really been cool to kind mm-hmm. of go, all right, well, what's, you know, go to these other, talk to people in these other countries, and, like, what's the same and what's different? And what I found is most of the things are the same. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the same kind of concerns and the same, I don't know, day-to-day things like that, you know.
Yeah.
So, and then, like, you know, there's different positions in different countries that they, you know, they have different names or they're kind of combinations of two things that we might have in the U.S. things like that. So it's all been very interesting to me to sort of discover all those things for myself.
Kind of a growth, a journey of growth is what I'm trying to say. Anyway, because I get it. You know, like you just, it does provide a medium to kind of explore who people are and then also yourself in that aspect. Like, because I know I learned from you and other people that I interview throughout, and like I gained some sort of knowledge about myself and like about the world, stuff that I may not be may have heard about but wasn't really like in tune to until I heard the story, and I was like, wow, like does add a different perspective and, you know, increases my awareness of it as well, as a podcaster. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah, and I think that's like the most fun, or the, yeah, maybe that's the right word. Because mm-hmm. when you learn something that perhaps you didn't expect, mm-hmm. you know, I try to do a lot of prep for my episodes to the point where I almost know what the answer to the question is going to be before mm-hmm. I ask it. But there are a lot of surprises, and then you go, all right, I never really thought about that. Mm-hmm. And then something I try to do is come up with follow-up questions. Mm-hmm. So whatever their answer happens to be, then I might ask another question and kind of go sort of follow that path for a little while and see where it goes. Right. And so when the first answer was a surprise, that can get on like a really fun tangent sometimes, mm-hmm. which I really enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Like when you're like, you were a chemical engineer. I'm like, when did I say that to people? and you found that I was like, all right, okay, good job. You know, like. Man, I started bringing that up more too. I was like, oh yeah, everybody, I graduated with a degree in chemical engineering. Not that I was hiding it, but like, that's just like, you know, it was something I did and then moved forward with that. But I did want to transition the conversation about topics of race and racism and conversations that I think are important for that for people to be more aware. So for you, do you feel like it's been difficult or been in environments where the concept of racism or race is difficult to talk about?
I feel like, especially lately, with mm-hmm. the conversations about race and racism, they've been so politically charged. So, for instance, when Black Lives Matter as a movement really gained steam, mm-hmm. and then you had to be, it seemed like either you were for that or you were for, you know, what was it called? The thin blue line or whatever. And it was mm-hmm. like either one or the other. And I always felt like, it doesn't, mm-hmm. it's not like that. It's not one or the other. You could, it wasn't that way to me. It wasn't a this or that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And I felt like people that made it that didn't really understand the situation. Now, of course, me being white, I don't really understand the situation either. And what mm-hmm. I found, that there were a lot of white people that were claiming that they knew what they were trying to define what it was, and I felt like they couldn't possibly know. Mm-hmm. So in that way, I think it was difficult because I didn't want to get into the politics of it, so I never really would talk about it. Mm-hmm. I don't talk about politics anyway, so that was kind of an extra thing added to that that I didn't like. And I also mm-hmm. felt like, you know, being white, that there was no possible way that I could understand these things. Because mm-hmm. it's nothing, you know, the things that you told me about your experience, in medical school, obviously I'd never been to medical school, but even in college or whatever, I didn't have to experience any of those things. Nobody ever said to me, you know, you don't belong here because you're white, you know, mm-hmm. or you shouldn't, you're not good enough to be in this program because you're white. Like, that doesn't happen, mm-hmm. you know, so I can't, you know, I would hear about these things and I couldn't understand them. Mm-hmm. So I felt like I didn't have anything to contribute to that conversation because it never happened to me and I have no idea what it's like. So wouldn't. And I found that, I found that, okay, instead of trying to go out there and say what I think, which, is, I think, irrelevant. I would listen. Like, okay, mm-hmm. what are people saying about this? What does that mean? And try to understand as much as I could. I don't know how effective that has been, but it's helped me to, I think, understand all these things a little bit more. And it's changed my point of view about racism, because I thought, you know, this is 2021. Why is this stuff still happening?
Right. Yeah.
You know, I don't get it. Why was it happening? I would hear these stories and like what, you know, and it was more of a shock to me because this wasn't something that I have to deal with on a day-to-day basis or ever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so when it did happen, when people would tell me about these things, it was like unbelievable to me. Not that I thought it didn't happen, but I couldn't understand it at all, I guess.
Right. Yeah. It was interesting too, because for me, black gay man here, that when I would be like in rotations and there was the person, like people who would come up to me and be like, well, what does Black Lives Matter mean? Like, what is this all about? And, you know, and it was just like, the fact that I have to, like, you know, you come to me and like, is it a conversation that leads to a, you know, growth in terms of your understanding of things and figuring out like what's going on, or is it more of just like, do you just want to be correct or incorrect in like what you're saying? Like, what is the purpose of the question, first of all? Because you can just kind of look things up and then say, hey, this is what I figured out, can you tell me, am I right and wrong in this perception about things? You know, like, there are things that I don't understand. Of course, I'm trying to learn too. And for me to be like, what is this about? And then trying to get a simple answer or answer that I feel like be correct for me would be like, that's not the purpose of like asking the question. It should be a dialogue and conversation. And so I always would be, you know, and oh yeah. Yeah. And so it, you know, it'd be that. And so, you know, it enrages too. Cause I know, when things happen, for example, like with me and my black colleagues, and because of the commonality, like we just know. We know the experiences. We know, like, you know, for example, I was talking to a colleague of mine, and like she's a black female, and she's in medicine. And so for her, she's like, all right, like I'm in medicine. That's great. But like when she interacts with a new group of, let's say, attendings or residents, people who are non-black, she's like, not only do I have to go through and, you know, fight whatever unconscious biases or implicit biases they may have, that they may or may not even be know that they have them, as a, like, as a female, but also as a black female, where I feel like it's been embedded that for some reason or another, well, through history, I'll say that, through, like, us learning through history about learning about history, I should say, that there's a, like, they've always been looked down upon, unfortunately, which sucks because I feel like I do have to say like black females have so much to give to, you know, the world, and we don't have to like put them in such a way that, you know, we put so like a superhuman debt on them to sort of solve the world, where they just can come and do stuff like at whatever position and level and help improve an environment. And that's me and in my biases. But we had this discussion and conversation, and I was just, and it was interesting because I was like, oh yeah, I know. Like, you know, I've seen my mother and I've seen what she had to go through. You know, I've seen my dad and see what he had to go through, and like, you know, we go through it in general, and we see like, yeah, we have to present in a specific way in order to be accepted and not seen as other in an aspect, because even though people can say, hey, like, no, I'm not racist, like, or I don't see race, or skin color, there's always those underlying unconscious things that people have learned growing up that is there, they may not be aware of it, or maybe they are aware of it, and then that affects the way that they see, like, for example, that trainee or doctor or a HISA technologist or physician in general. So I think it was just, like, interesting that you brought that up.
Yeah. I mean, and I've been thinking, you know, lately about, all right, how many pathologists have I worked with, you know, over the years? that have been, you know, Black or Hispanic or mm-hmm. I don't know, Indian, you know, and not a lot. Mm-hmm. Most of them have been white. And I, you know, and the more that I started noticing these things, mm-hmm. the more that other things like that became apparent to me. And then mm-hmm. I started thinking, all right, why is it like that? You know, and then I start to hear these different stories about the way, you know, like you told me, the way that, you know, you're treated or other people were treated and why, mm-hmm. you know, people would quit pathology or just, you know, quit medicine completely because of the way they were treated. And it's like, all right, mm-hmm. why does that happen? Why is this still a thing? Mm-hmm. And it's, mm-hmm. yeah, like you said, about having the conversations, like that's the way I try to approach it. And it's tough mm-hmm. these days because there's a lot of people that aren't looking to have a conversation. Mm-hmm. They're looking to tell you either you're wrong or well, mostly that you're wrong or maybe that you're right. And, you know, and I can understand, you know, like I'm going to go up to just a random Black person and be like, well, tell me about your story. I would think that they'd be very suspicious of that mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. so many people just want to come and, you know, start a fight. When all the protests were happening mm-hmm. around the mm-hmm. country, there were some here in Milwaukee. There was a big march downtown. And I remember talking about this with my wife. I wanted to go down there and just like, you know, find somebody and be, hey, you know, I'll walk with you. If you tell mm-hmm. me your story, why are you here? What mm-hmm. is it about this movement that speaks to you? But I didn't do it because there were a lot of people that look like me that were down there that were doing the exact opposite of that. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to be mistaken for that. So it was kind of out of fear. And I really kind of, I regret that I didn't do that because now that I've had conversations with people about these types of things, And I've learned so much, you know, it mm-hmm. really, like I said, I could never completely understand any of this, but I feel like I understand it more than I did mm-hmm. maybe a year ago.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Just like having the conversations for sure, like we were saying. And that goes towards yeah. the next question about like allyship and what your definition mm-hmm. of allyship is.
You know, maybe, okay, someone who's maybe a friend, but also someone who will help if mm-hmm. if they're, you know, if you need help. And by that I mean, like, I try to use the podcast, the platform that I have to help, to make a sort of a statement or a positive impact on issues mm-hmm. like this. Mm-hmm. You know, there was, you know, when all of these things started happening and really everything was kind of gaining steam and people would, you know, There were like statements from all these different organizations, like we condemn racism and we don't mm-hmm. have any, there's no place for that in our organizations. And I think that's great, mm-hmm. but I felt like, why do you have to make a statement like this? Shouldn't you be conducting yourself in this way all of the time? Mm-hmm. No one would ever question like, oh, what about this organization? They're probably racist. Like they should be able to look at your history of everything you've ever done and go, no, that's, I don't know. Like, I wanted to ask you about this, actually. Like, am I wrong about this? Does that, what kind of message that, or what did that say to you that all these organizations were coming out with these statements? Like, did that help? Did you feel more understood, I guess?
Oh, that's a good question. For me, and this is just me.
Not to flip the script here, but.
I know, flip the script. No. You know, with all that was happening, it was such a rarity of a lot of emotions that are occurring. And I alluded to this somewhere or talked about it somewhere, but when I was seeing that there were organizations that were saying like racism is a public health issue or public health crisis, and mm-hmm. me being me, I said, well, of course it is. Like this is something we've known for like decades, like for years. Like, you know, when people yeah. go to like, or, you know, a person of color goes to a doctor and they get treated one way or a certain way compared to like if somebody else is another person of color goes and gets treated a better way. Well, I should say a better way. When they go to, another person of color goes to the physician and gets treated a different way. Like, there's something there. Mm-hmm. There's something that's going on. I mean, this is a skin color, you know, issue along with the experiments and mistrust that's established within the black and brown communities as well. So when I seen, you know, those statements, like, it didn't really affect me too much. Like, I wasn't like, oh, wow, like, finally, like, somebody notices, you know, because I've known that this should have been something that would have been, should have been, like, established throughout. Now, I don't know what all the different organizations have done, or, like, if there are any experiences of like, them not handling themselves in that conduct prior to making their statements. But for me, what is interesting, or what proves to me that they're basically getting, that they are saying that they are sticking to their statement against racism, is the way that, you know, their hiring practices, and also how they handle against discrimination, like, within their organization, and, like, how they say they're, like, how they make it a better process for those that are within it. How do they, you know, show decreased mortalities within, you know, the black or brown populations, if that is an issue? Like, how do they deal with the issues of racism within their organization, if they have a statement saying they are against racism? And not just racism, like, I think the term has come up too, like, anti-racism, right? Because we have to talk about, like, how do we make sure that we, you know, like, in all the principles that are within it, we have to make sure that if this is a statement that you're saying, or one of your mission values, that you are sticking to it by showing people and, you know, the stakeholders, meaning the patients, the physicians, the nurses, the environmental staff, everybody that's within the hospital, that you're showing them that you are sticking to that mission value by dealing with those issues that pop up and arise, and you're not just putting that up. I do think, and I'm going off on a tangent here, but I think it's interesting for me when, if an organization or if a university has that as a mission statement, like, on every page that they have, for example, because I know I've heard or seen there are some organizations, or say, like, medical institutions that have that, like, racism, we stand against racism, and that they are about diversity and inclusion. And then when you see or look at the website, for example, about the, like, about, let's say, just in medicine, let's say physicians and residents, and it's all a homogeneous population, like, there's no people of color that's there. I don't know what that, like, I don't know why you have that statement on there at all, because it doesn't really reflect what you're doing. If your residents and staff are not reflective in your statement, then to me that is performative. Like, you might as well just take it off. Uh-huh. And until you can show, like, that statement has been something that you stand by. So that's my long answer to the reverse question. It's like reverse Uno.
Okay. No, that's helpful, because I thought too, like, okay, this is my opinion about it, but, like, again, I'm white, so what does it matter? But it's like, yeah, it's real easy. Like, it became like everybody was going, oh, well, we're not racist, you know, right? And then there's our statement, and it's fine. It's like, well, that's great, but I feel like you're diluting the conversation by calling attention to yourself. Mm-hmm. Or to your organization, rather than the real issue. So that was something that I didn't want to do.
I think, like, if we can stay on this topic for a bit. What was when, like, after the death of George Floyd, and the statements were coming out, there were some of my colleagues who, you know, worked in these institutions where there was like, okay, we need to focus on diversity and inclusion, and then put the burden on those residents to, like, come up with a plan for diversity and inclusion. So it wasn't really, like, organization, but, all right, like, you are the representatives of diversity and inclusion within our organization, within our residency. You know, let's like come up with a plan so we can like show what we're doing, you know. So instead of it being a team effort, it became like, again, putting the effort and bearing on the residents of color to basically come up with what should be done and like how much of the, and if they do have really great ideas to say, you know what, up top of their responsibilities to patients and whatever else, and in general, like if they do have several like ideas that are good and say, hey, we can incorporate that into, you know, what you tasked us to do, are those actually going to be listened to? Because one of the problems is when there are ways of saying, okay, how do we make things more diverse and inclusive? Do we put it through, okay, this is everybody's, like, this is what everybody should do, or do we do it like through the white gaze and make it comfortable for like white people before we actually make it comfortable for everybody else? And I do think times that does occur, which sucks. If that makes
sense. Yeah. No, that's it does make sense. That's mm-hmm. a really good point. And you know, I don't know. I had a real problem with it, and mm-hmm. you know, or people would, you know, black out their profile picture or whatever for a week or a month or whatever it was. It's like, well, that's great, but that doesn't really do anything. And again, you're just calling attention to yourself mm-hmm. instead of, mm-hmm. you know, so I would, like I said earlier, I would kind of, I step back and I'm like, all right, I'm going to listen or I'm going to read, you know, right. what mm-hmm. people are saying. And it's like, try to understand. Mm-hmm. And then if I have something to say about it based on all of that, then I'll say it. But I, you know, like I said, it's so foreign to me that there was so much, I don't even know the words to describe it. It just became like overwhelming. Like there's so much to this and I had no idea.
Yeah.
So I was
yeah.
just trying to learn as much as mm-hmm. I could.
So when you say about like listening and having like the conversations with people when it comes up to it, like, is that how you feel like you express your allyship too? Like hearing the conversations, having them, reading and learning and kind of growing in that aspect and then going on from there?
I think so. I try to do that. I mean, even with, you know, some residents at work and just other people that I know, like, you know, some of our residents are not from the U.S. And mm-hmm. so I'll ask about, mm-hmm. you know, wherever they're from and what was it like there and that kind of thing, which is a little different than what you're talking about, but it's still, mm-hmm. I try to listen to what people have to say and what is your experience. And then, because mm-hmm. It's certainly not going to be the same as mine. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of filters mm-hmm. How you deal with things and how you react to things. And I want to sort of be sensitive to that if I can.
Right. Right.
So, yeah. So that's that kind of thing. Like you have to know a little bit about the person first before you can do those right. kind of things. Right.
Mm-hmm. And no, I agree. Like, especially with our international colleagues and like things that
yeah.
is common where they grew up, like, you know, within their culture and stuff, but like here it's in America where it's different, and we don't understand that bridge or connection unless the conversation, you know, occurs. So I completely understand in that aspect. So can you tell us about your involvement with AAPA? So for those who don't know, can you tell us what the acronym stands for and how you got involved with it?
Yeah, so that's American Association of Pathologist Assistants. And this, let's see, so a little history. The organization started in 1972 when there was, I think, just one PA program at, I believe it was at Duke. But so the way I got involved, as part of the kind of on-the-job training, you had to submit your personal information and like information about there was like a list of different types of specimens, and you had to submit like de-identified pathology reports that showed your gross description as proof that you've done these things and a certain number of autopsies and stuff like that. So you had to submit this packet of, it was actually, I think, paper at the time rather than electronic. So I kind of got familiar with the organization then. And then, you know, once you take the exam, then you're like a fellow member. A couple years later, there was like a quarterly newsletter. And I thought, well, you know, I've enjoyed writing and, you know, enjoyed reading a lot of these articles that are in here. Maybe I could try, you know, joining the newsletter committee and doing some writing. So I did that. And then the person who was the chair at the time, her name's Tisa, and she was going to step down because she'd done it for, I think, 10 years or something. And so then somebody else needed to be the chair of the committee. And for some reason, I thought, all right, I'll give it a try. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know anything about working with the newsletter and the editing that was involved there. And much like, you know, later on, you know, starting a podcast. So you have to learn about how to do all these things. And then, you know, so I did that. And eventually the newsletter, we kind of transitioned it into a journal. So which is now is still around. It's called The Cutting Edge. And so that was the editor in chief of that for a few years when that got started. And we added new features and we did all these other things. And because of all of that, I eventually got nominated for our governing body, the Board of Trustees, it's called. So I got elected to that. That was in 2018, I believe. And so that was a 3-year term. And then during that time, you have like your officers of the board. So there's the chair, the vice chair, and the CFO. So I decided I would volunteer to be the CFO. So did that for a couple of years. And that was just like, again, all of these roles, like learning more things and, you know, even just being on the board, just learning like the inner workings of how an organization like this runs, which a lot of things that I didn't know, and the different issues that you have to deal with. And then, you know, in the CFO position, like, okay, what money is coming in, what money is going out, and how much, you know, things cost, like putting on a conference, and how much it costs for coffee, which is ridiculous. But just things like that.
Yeah.
And I remember, last year we had to talk about, were we going to cancel conferences and, you know, were we going to make them virtual and what were we going to do? And like, what was the timeline for alerting people of what was going on and all these things, you know, cause it was all brand new. This stuff has never happened before. Mm-hmm. So it was all these things. And just like, I learned a lot about it, and it was a really good experience for me. And I think that anybody who, you know, I felt like it's important to get involved in professional organizations, which whatever organization that might be, whether it's, you know, AAPA like me, if it's ASCP, ASCLS, there's the NSH for histotechs, I think ASC for cytotechs, whatever your organization is, I think it's good to get involved with those things because you learn, you'll learn new skills and you'll meet a lot of interesting people. And that was the other part of it too. Like I met all these different people from different backgrounds and, you know, so there's kind of the diversity thing there and, you know, kind of a little like exposure to that. And then being part of the board, we had to keep those things in mind. And it was things I had never had to think about before. So that was really good for me. And it, like you said earlier, kind of the growth aspect. So that was definitely a part of it.
Okay. And then I have two last questions to ask. So we know we talked about your involvement with AAPA being part of the governing board and part of the organization. What are ways you think after like serving that, that we can diversify in pathology, especially with pathology assistants? What are ways you've seen, or resources that can be utilized in order to diversify in that aspect?
So this, I'm going to kind of reference the conversation I had with Dr. Carla Ellis, because she really changed my point of view in this aspect. So I was talking with her about mentors and mentorship. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And she said that, you know, it's important to have mentors that look like you or that have a similar background to what you have. And I thought about that for a while, and I thought, okay, because for me, you know, if I want to find a mentor that's a white male, well, that's easy. You know, I had a lot of them, you know, but, you know, for her, finding a mentor who was a black female, that was a little bit tougher to do. And she said, you know, people getting into the field, if there's not other people that have a similar background, it's a little bit harder to do, and they might be a little bit more reluctant to get into that field. Mm-hmm. So I think you have to have, before you can say, you know, we need to have a more diverse workforce, more diverse organization, you've got to have people in place that are able to somehow connect with those people coming up and, mm-hmm. and mentor them, or at least just talk to them, you know, and then it kind of has that sort of snowball effect, where once you've got a couple, and then they can mentor sort of the next generation, and then it expands from there, because the people say, okay, there's other people here that I can relate to. Uh-huh. And I don't know how you start that process, really. That, you know, that's something I've been thinking about. I don't know how you would do that, but I think you have to have something like that in place, whether it's, you know, AAPA or any other organization, okay. in order to kind of start that ball rolling. If that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then the last question I had was, what are ways listeners can follow you and your podcast so they can see how it flourishes throughout the years?
Okay. So, well, the People of Pathology podcast is on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, pretty much any podcast platform now. You can also follow on Twitter. The Twitter account is at People of Path. Or if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's at DStrengthPA. I've also started doing a little bit on Instagram, which is also at People of Path. And then and LinkedIn as well. That's just me under my own name. But I do post quite a bit about the podcast there.
Hi again, friends. Well, this is it for today's episode. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy day to listen to the Diversifying Math podcast. Hope you enjoyed the episode, and hope to see you soon.